Do you manage your own IT for distributed teams in Asia? And you know how painful it is. Essavel helps your in-house team by taking cumbersome tasks off their hands and giving them the tools to manage IT effectively. Get help across 8 countries in Asia Pacific, from on and offboarding, procuring devices, to real-time IT support and device management. With our state-of-the-art platform, gain full control of all your IT infrastructure in one place. Our team of IT support pros are keen to help you grow. So check out esevel.com and get a demo today. Use our referral code ASIA for 3 months free. Terms and conditions apply.
Before a Zoom down happens, I'm sure TikTok, let alone ByteDance as a company as a whole, will survive and maybe even continue to thrive after this. Because let's put things into perspective, right? TikTok has more than 1 billion users globally. And then the US represents just a little over a tenth of that, 178 million. So I'm not saying that it's not going to impact TikTok and ByteDance, but does it pose a existential threat? Probably not. I believe, given we already talked about how ByteDance has been super profitable, I actually think that even if they get banned in the US, it's by no means the end of TikTok or ByteDance.
Welcome to Analyze Asia, the premier podcast dedicated to dissecting the pulse of business, technology, and media in Asia. I'm Bernard Leong, and we're now going through the latest iteration on TikTok, how TikTok is going to be banned in the United States. What does it mean for the global investors, content creators, and users on the TikTok platform, whether it's in the US or everywhere else in the world? And what is their path forward? With me today, Jing Yang, Asia Bureau Chief from The Information. Yes, that The Information. Jing, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here and thank you for having me.
Yes, and I definitely have to tell you, I've hosted most of your colleagues from The Information on the podcast for many times. And I also want to get to know you. I want to start from your origin story. How did you start your career?
I started economics in my undergrad, and then I was fascinated by how I can understand the world through the lens of economy and the flow of capital. But I also like, you know, writing and reading a lot. So then I figured maybe the best way for me to build a career is to be a journalist reporting on finance and business and technology. So that's how I got started.
And then from there, how did you eventually come to join as the Asia Bureau Chief from The Information itself?
Yeah, so I was born and raised in mainland China and then came to Hong Kong to pursue postgraduate studies in journalism more than 10 years ago. And from there, I started working my way up in the industry. I started out as a reporter covering shipping at a maritime publication called Lloyd's List. Then from there, I have spent time at the Hong Kong-based newspaper, South China Morning Post, then Bloomberg, and then the Wall Street Journal. And eventually, about a year ago, I was approached by The Information with this exciting opportunity. And after some serious consideration, I decided to join them. But one thing that didn't change in the last decade plus is that I've always sort of focused my career on writing about the Chinese economy, business, and finance to a broader audience that is interested in learning about China.
Mm. You have a pretty interesting background. I mean, you have actually covered different topics, maybe through South China Morning Post, Bloomberg, and Wall Street Journal, and now The Information. From your career journey, what are the lessons you can share with my audience?
Maybe a couple of things. I think from a career development perspective, I will say that, you know, always stay curious and hungry. One of the reasons I've stayed in this industry is that I feel like this is one of the few jobs in the world I can think of that pays you to learn every day, which is super rewarding and exciting. Not a day goes by where I'm not learning new things. And I think that probably rings true to most of other lines of work as well, where you just have to stay hungry and stay curious. Another thing would be, you know, just as a sort of observer of how things have been in the last decade plus, is, you know, when I'm writing about China to like a broader or global audience, I do find the feedback I'm getting has varied or transformed throughout the years. The understanding of China and the underlying driver of why people are curious about China or why not is quite interesting. And we can talk about some of that maybe as we get on the TikTok story.
Yeah. And that is what we wanted to talk about, the main subject of the day. And is TikTok going to be banned this time? So the information have broken a few stories, which we will talk about along the way. But let's start at the beginning. This is the second time that the US is trying to ban TikTok. The last time was 4 years ago when Donald Trump wanted TikTok to divest. So can you talk about the chronology of events that led to the US Congress with, I think, 353 to 65 votes to pass a bill last week to force TikTok into divestment? And if not, then they will be banned in the US.
Yeah, sure. Actually, if I may take a step back, I would probably count it as a third attempt from the US, because if we include the Restrict Act, which was another bill that was introduced about a year ago, actually by the Senate, but that, you know, didn't really get enough votes or support. I believe it was never put to a vote.
Yep.
But that bill was also crafted to ban Chinese-owned apps, including TikTok. So if we count that, then there is, like, we can say three sort of federal-level attempts to ban TikTok. And then if you include, you know, state-level legislation, such as one we've seen in Montana last year, then I think there will be many more. But to in terms of chronology, obviously, I think what has made this time really remarkable is the speed at which the legislation sailed through the House. You know, on March 5th, two House of Representatives, Mike Gallagher, who's a Republican, and Raja Thi, who's a Democrat, introduced this bill, which is officially called Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary Controlled Applications Act. And then 2 days later, the bill was voted 50-0 by the House Energy and Commerce Committee. And then on March 13th, it was put through, you know, the vote by the entire House, as you noted, 352-65. So in summary, the bill went through, you know, sailed through the House in just 8 days from being introduced to being passed. And now it's in the hands of the Senate.
Yeah. So depending on the U.S. Senate, and President Biden has already said that he will sign on to the actual bill, I guess what are the chances of a ban likely to happen? I don't think we can make crystal ball predictions, but just looking at how things are moving forward, just looking at the bigger picture.
Yeah. I, like you, I don't profess to be well-versed in the workings of DC politics. But if we just look at from like a practical, you know, if past evidence is any guidance, let's assume that first, I think there remains to be quite a division within Senate, whether or not they want to put this to a vote, or maybe they want to do some revisions. And then if they do a revision, then they'll be kicked back to the House, right? And then, you know, let's assume that somehow both the House and Senate pass a version they both agree on and it got signed by Biden, then, you know, I think it's widely expected that TikTok or TikTok users will resort to legal measures to fight this. There could be, according to past experiences, for example, either TikTok or TikTok users could band together to apply for an injunction with the court, which will then, you know, put a stop on the bill being taken, you know, being effective, while they sort of argue the merits and whether it is constitutional. And then this could all take, you know, at least months, if not, you know, longer than that, to play out. And then bear in mind, we have the U.S. election coming up later toward end of this year, and whether that will influence the sending of the bill or the legislature is another question.
And then, of course, Chu Shouzhi, which is the Singaporean CEO from TikTok, responded. What are the official arguments from their point of view against the U.S. in coming up with such a bill to make a ban if they don't divest?
Yeah, so I think in the first week, when the bill was introduced, what we saw was sort of like a you could call a war words between TikTok side and the House of Representative side. The Congress members who introduced and supported the bill argued that this is not a bill that attempts to be an outright ban on TikTok in the U.S. If I were to quote, what Mike Gallagher said at the time during a press conference, he said that imagine it as a surgery designed to remove the tumor in TikTok and, you know, the tumor being Biden's, the parent. And so they felt that they, within the scope of the bill, they offered a solution that does not have to necessarily end with a ban. But from TikTok side, they see this legislation has a predetermined outcome, which is a total ban on TikTok. And then they argue that it encroaches on, you know, the right of free expression. And obviously they also argue that it will damage the millions of small businesses or creators that rely on TikTok as a source of income and, you know, where they depend their livelihoods on.
As I understand, TikTok is very popular in the US. I think it's about 170 million users. What are the implications for TikTok being banned in the US? How does it impact the content creators and users in that market itself?
I would answer that question probably by looking at the first major country that banned TikTok, which is India, which happened in mid-2020. And yeah. At that time, if you remember, I believed India was the biggest market for TikTok, where it had 200 million users. And we saw sort of similar pushback and similar worries from the users and creator community from India at the time. And obviously, there was a sort of period where there was, you know, pain and a lot of impact felt by influencers and users. But then what also happened quickly after was that you have, you know, for example, American social media giants, you know, seized on the opportunity trying to fill the void. You know, Meta, Instagram launched Instagram Reels in India just within a week of the ban. Google also introduced, you know, YouTube Shorts around the same time there. And then there are also homegrown platforms that also rose to the occasion and try to fill the void. And eventually, I think what people say nowadays is that it's been okay. Like, you know, they felt that they can live without TikTok to some extent.
Mm. So what's the one thing that you know about this current TikTok situation that very few do think about or look at in?
I will probably say the one thing would be how, you know, TikTok, a lot of people, I think, within TikTok have been frustrated by how heavily politicized the latest situation has been. And I believe we're going to talk about this next. But as you're probably aware that TikTok spent a lot of money and a lot of resources in the last 2.5 years on trying to come up with a data security plan as an answer to the concerns over national security. And however, what seems to be absent, you know, or not being talked enough about in their point of view in the latest round of legislative efforts is that, you know, no one looked at or gave any credit to this effort that we made, and it's all being focused on the ownership and, you know, the Chinese Communist Party's potential influence over that ownership.
This is where we want to talk about the three stories. Just for all my audience, this video will probably come out the next week or the week after. So the evolving situation is going to go, but I think that for the past week, the information have broke three major stories. I think we even interchanged and made some changes because of the new article that just came out 2 days back. So I want to start off with the first story, which is what factors led to TikTok's misjudgment of the political situation in the US? I mean, specifically in the bill to force them to dissociate from ByteDance. I think this was the latest one where it's the article on TikTok spent years of developing data security plan, but Washington just simply ignored it.
Yeah. So maybe let's talk about the historic context a little bit, right? The TIC was launched in 2017, I believe, as a sort of the overseas counterpart of Douyin, which already had a lot of success in China at the time. And then shortly after that, ByteDance acquired Musical.ly, which is also a Chinese-owned app, but then had a sizable audience, user base in the US. And then after that acquisition, you know, Musical.ly was merged into TikTok. And then that acquisition happened in 2017. And in 2019, CFIUS, which is the US government agency that reviews on inbound investments for national security reasons, started to look into this transaction and trying to find out whether, you know, this deal poses any national security risk to the US. And so it all started from there. I think because this is how it got started, TikTok's approach to addressing that concern is by providing a technical solution. And COVID happened, right? Trump became president and lost an election. And then US-China relationships deteriorated in so many different aspects. So eventually what happened was like the situation or the discussions around TikTok became much more politicized. While during, you know, during the time when TikTok proposed this data security fix, which they call Project Texas, and the name originates from the tech partner they had, which is Oracle, which is headquartered in Texas. So they felt that they could, you know, they felt that Project Texas was sufficient to address that concern. They felt it was a massive, I mean, it is a massive undertaking and a very sophisticated solution if implemented completely. And so during that time, you know, between like 2021 and 2022, there were already like internal recommendations made to TikTok's management and their policy team that, you know, maybe as we negotiate this security plan with the CFIUS, we should also try to have more conversations with lawmakers to sort of enhance the understanding of our business and then to build some support at a broader level. But that recommendation weren't really taken on board. And one of the reasons, as reported, is because TikTok leaders at the time felt like they didn't want to rock the boat unnecessarily by creating like new avenues of conversations or engagement, since that the problem, or at least the entity that poses the problem is the executive branch, then we should just focus on that.
So can you discuss the motivations and challenges that TikTok face? Because they have to restructure their operations and then also investing that $1.5 billion to create actually a separate data security unit that is actually part of this Project Texas efforts.
Yeah, I mean, the motivation is, I think, pure and simple, right? They feel that since there is concerns over, you know, whether first the parent company ByteDance is able to access US user data, then we should try to build a system where all the US user data is walled off on US servers run by a US company. And the challenges are, there are a lot of challenges, right? I mean, when they started the program, they didn't have like as many as 170 million users, but it was also, you know, probably in the realm of 100 million, right? And what they essentially had to do is to basically shift all of that data to a different, you know, series of servers run by Oracle. And then they also need to share the source code. They need to make Oracle able to access the algorithms and the source code that run TikTok in the US. And then that's only sort of captures the static part of the data, right? So for historical data that, you know, prior to the transfer, it also needs to go through, you know, rounds of data deletion on existing servers. And then at some point on, say, for example, employees' laptops. So all of this is a, you know, massive multi-year undertaking. It costs a lot of money and a lot of manpower. And as we also reported, the end result of that is it also has created it also added to sort of the bureaucracy and operational inefficiency when it comes to running TikTok. For example, now, you know, Project Texas is already in place and operational. Mm-hmm. If product managers in the US want to, you know, install some new features to the app, then they have to get, they have to go through the entity over, you know, guarding the data in the US. And there is, you know, always a queue of a lot of like new features or changes waiting for that entity's review, because that entity also doesn't have sufficient workforce at the moment. So bear in mind another piece, another very important piece to all of this is that, as we reported, at some time, you know, maybe from like late 2022 or 2023, CFIUS has just stopped, you know, engaging with TikTok on this data security plan. So what TikTok did basically essentially was that they chose to still go ahead and implement Project Texas as a pretty much a voluntary thing and also as a show of good faith. But the idea is that Project Texas should be run by a board, and then the appointees to the board need to be approved by CFIUS. So without that, it remains incomplete. And then so this massive undertaking right now is still pretty much in limbo. So on one hand, and then, you know, given the events in the past 2 weeks, right? On one hand, Project Texas has not really scored any points or any political points in the latest round of, you know, actions against TikTok. On the other hand, it has already created the additional like operational bureaucracy and inefficiency I just talked about. So in a way, you know, some people in TikTok feel like they are caught in a lose-lose situation.
Right. This is interesting because you're pointing out the US concerns about data security part, and then also that they also created their own bureaucracy as well. I guess there was one part really in the article that talks about the US data security service. I guess what has the operational difficulties from the establishment of the USDS have actually posed for TikTok, and how is it being perceived by the company itself?
Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, right, you know, any changes made to the app in the US have to be, you know, and, you know, if you want to roll out any new product features, they have to be approved by staff at within US Data Security or USDS. And so that just makes it very, you know, time consuming. And another issue is that because it never really, you know, the whole, you know, Project Texas never really got the stamp approval from CFIUS. So TikTok in a way is caught in, you know, yes, we want to do this, but, you know, we don't know if this is going to work. Then should we continue to throw, you know, our, you know, funding
resources.
Yeah. And then so in a way, US data security has been sort of perceived as a dead end or inside TikTok. Like say, okay, if your job is being transferred to USDS, maybe that's seen as like, okay, your career is not really progressing. People don't want to work there. That also created a different problem.
Okay. So this is interesting, right? Because Chu Suzutsu came in, took over as a CEO, and he also took over the US negotiations when he came on board. How did he manage the negotiations, at least with the CFIUS and US data security team and Congress as well? I mean, all the three different fronts. Oh, did he contribute in some or did he not do? Did he not focus on some? Like he went to all the hearings and got a lot of people shouting at him and asking him if he's a Chinese citizen, but he's living in Singapore and is a Singaporean.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I don't know how you feel, but personally, I find, you know, that most recent hearing and the hearing last year, I find it very hard to watch. Yeah, I mean, it's just like in so many ways, I think for people in Asia, it's quite jaw-dropping. I don't know if you agree.
I agree with you. As a Singaporean, I felt bad for him. And I even voiced out my unhappiness, and some of my American friends actually apologized because I made a comment that half of the US Senate doesn't know where Singapore is. They thought it's part of China. And I keep
doing that?
Yeah, obviously, I have a lot of Singaporean friends. And I remember the last hearing, right, the one that happened a year ago. I think a lot of Singapore, what I heard was a lot of Singaporeans were cheering for how he did it.
Yeah.
And he really, I think one thing that was conveyed to me was like, it really put Singapore on the map for the average Americans. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. As for how, let's come back to the question. How does the communication actually and decision-making style have actually affected TikTok's approach in addressing these US concerns about data security and Chinese ownership then?
Yeah. So maybe I'll answer the question in two parts. First part is most of the negotiation over Project Texas, as we understand from the reporting, was led and overseen by Eric Anderson, who is TikTok's general counsel. The key executive leading the TikTok negotiations with CFIUS over Project Texas was Eric Anderson, who's TikTok's general counsel, and he was also in charge of the policy team. They call it policy team, but essentially it handles government relations. He was somewhat known as a cautious or prudent leader, so which goes back to what we talked earlier about sort of didn't want to rock the boat, didn't see the need to engage with lawmakers when they were focused on talking to the executive branch. So I think it's probably, I mean, my observation as a journalist throughout the years is that in overall, the leadership of both ByteDance and TikTok are quite media shy. And for example, you know, ByteDance founder Zhang Yiming rarely gives press interviews. So Mr. Chu for a long time also didn't really, you know, stand in the spotlight for a lot until late 2022 or beginning of 2023, when his congressional hearing was scheduled. The hearing happened in March 2023, but prior to that, when they knew that the hearing was going to happen, TikTok started with, you know, more proactive public and media outreach, whereby Chu himself spent a month meeting with lawmakers in DC. And he also did a lot of interviews with, you know, publications like the Washington Journal, New York Times, etc. My sort of takeaway is that the general public didn't have a chance to really hear from him directly or through media interviews or through video or TV appearances until that time.
So how do we now access ByteDance and TikTok's team in handling the whole issue with the US? Do you think that they have failed in a way, or maybe it's just a mixed bag because things are just moving so fast and so quickly that they cannot react?
If we just look back in time a little bit, right? First, let's take stock of Chu's hearing in March 2023.
Yep.
At that time, based on the reporting, actually internally, his hearing was seen as a big success because a lot of the discussion points in that hearing were related to Restrict Act. And actually, the hearing helped galvanize a position against the Restrict Act. And the consensus came from different points of view. Some say that the act would give the government too much power. Some say that, you know, what we really need is a federal privacy bill to tackle the issue, you know, social media, how social media gather and utilize, you know, user data. So it worked for like the better part of a year. In a way, I feel like this latest bill almost like snuck upon, you know, TikTok and ByteDance management and many other, you know, observers of the situation. Maybe in a way it's because they, you know, they learned that they shouldn't, you know, they have to keep this under wraps. Otherwise, there will already be a position, you know, coming in the middle of that. And going back to your question, I think it's easy to say, oh, in hindsight, oh, they should have done this, they should have done that, right? I don't think it's necessarily meaningful to say that now because you cannot cry over spilled milk.
Yep.
Essentially, I think the way I would summarize the situation is that TikTok believed that they could use TikTok believed that they could provide a technical solution to the problem. However, the problem became much more politicized than they initially expected. So eventually, where we are now is that you can't really solve a political problem with a technical solution.
That's probably a very good insight to the conversation. So I want to get to the second article, which concerns TikTok losing money. For a long time, from different sources I have, ByteDance have been known to be printing money with Douyin. So I was actually quite surprised when I read the information's article on TikTok losing money. I mean, given that also that ByteDance has never disclosed TikTok's financial performance. I guess, how do you assess, say, the impact of the so-called reported losses on investors' confidence and also the long-term sustainability of the app? I think probably a very significant of the resources is actually dedicated to things like project taxes, managing the US governmental relations and all that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So maybe let's break it down to two parts. Let's talk about like why TikTok is still in the red after all these years. So as you mentioned, project taxes, you know, I think they said that they spent $1.5 billion to start that program, and they probably need at least several hundred millions of dollars each year to sustain that project if they were to go on. And then on top of that, unlike Douyin, so the reason, as our reporting shows, is that TikTok basically has to, you know, the operational and labor costs into running TikTok in overseas markets, especially developed markets, are much higher than, say, running Douyin in China. And another reason to that is also TikTok has been implementing some new initiatives such as e-commerce or TikTok Shop. We also reported last year that TikTok Shop was going to lose about $500 million last year just to get TikTok Shop off the ground. And whereas if you look at Douyin, they started on the, you know, live streaming commerce much earlier, and then they managed to already turn it into a money-making machine. These are the reasons that, you know, contributed to TikTok's losses. And I also want to point another thing. As you know, TikTok had to essentially acquire Tokopedia Indonesia in order to get back into the e-commerce market there. And as you know, Tokopedia also is loss-making. So that transaction was announced in December last year, right? So yes. I think we can probably safely assume that the transaction and Tokopedia's loss will also contribute to TikTok's losses this year.
So if that's the case, then how does the potential ban on TikTok would affect its financial performance and efforts to become profitable? If the losses will also impact its ability to raise future funding or even affect its valuations in the eyes of the current and potential investors, and possibly at some point ByteDance needs to go public, right?
Yeah. Okay. Let me try to answer that one by one. Yeah. So it's very hard to say. Let's assume, okay, first, let's assume that TikTok has to shut down in the US. Obviously, then they are losing a very large source of revenue. The understanding, I think, is that TikTok probably loses less in the US than elsewhere because the US is the world's largest advertising market, right? So presumably, you can generate more revenue from, you know, per user in the US than elsewhere. So that's right. Definitely going to pose some sort of top line pressure for TikTok. However, I don't think that necessarily means the end for TikTok or ByteDance. You asked me earlier about investor confidence. Funny thing here is that, not funny, but like the ironic thing here is that back in 2020, we saw many investors, especially big influential American investors, rose to the occasion and try to lobby one way or the other against a ban. But this time around, we didn't see that happen. We can get into why later, but the sentiment I'm getting from the investors is that they want an exit one way or the other. One of the reasons why ByteDance has not been able to go public, or we don't even see like a path an IPO, is because of this massive overhang of, you know, political uncertainty in the US. Let's say if a push comes to shove that TikTok has to pull out of the US, at least that means some kind of resolution of this massive overhang. And then maybe then you actually can see a clearer path toward IPO, ergo, you know, exit. I think that's what some investors are thinking. And then so that also relates to your fundraising question, right? Actually, I wouldn't worry about that if I were, you know, ByteDance, because ByteDance has been extremely profitable, right? We reported it, and I think other media outlets also reported that ByteDance has been able to post, you know, constantly approximately 40% top line growth in the last few quarters. And then they have also been, I mean, the revenue is almost on par with that of Meta. And then they have also been very profitable. We're not seeing any signs of, say, you know, ByteDance needing another round of funding because they are quite self-sustaining. So I don't think that is an issue at the moment.
Mm. So I will come to the last article, which actually is the article relating to the ByteDance investors have actually distanced themselves from the TikTok app. I guess, what do you believe has actually caused this shift in the investors' approach towards supporting TikTok now compared to the mobilization in 2020 during the Trump administration's attempt to ban the app?
Yeah. So probably one of the biggest factors that caused this difference is this, what I like to call the decoupling of venture capital between the US and China. So as you know, some of the biggest investors in ByteDance are VC firms. Like, you know, Sequoia Capital, General Atlantic, et cetera, et cetera. And then we all know that, you know, Sequoia Capital led their US, China, and Southeast Asia operations almost, you know, last year. Mm. Some of that, I mean, part of the reason for that decision is geopolitical concerns. Back in 2020, Sequoia, you know, in the US, the leaders of Sequoia in the US were able to, were able to rise to the occasion and put in, exert some of their influence to help diffuse the tension. But this time around, some of these investors themselves have already been under similar kind of pressure and been going through similar kind of, you know, congressional, you know, investigations or questioning. So in a way, they have already been struggling to, you know, to sort of stabilize on their own when it comes to geopolitical rift in the past probably 12 months. So that's why this time around, you don't see similar kind of support being lined up. And that's a very big reason. And probably I will say a second sort of side reason is that last time it didn't really, I don't know. I mean, it seems like last time, their efforts didn't really make a difference. I think what happened was basically, you know, Biden came in to become the new president. And then, you know, some of the past initiatives were sort of either put on hold or unwind, right? So, you know, if you feel like, you know, on one hand, you are already not able to do this. On the other hand, you know, even if you did, it's probably not going to make a big difference, then why would you bother, right?
That also happens not just for Sequoia. I think GGV Capital is probably the other one, which have interest in both US and they also have to decouple. So how do investors then have to reconcile the financial interest in ByteDance with the national security concerns that's raised by the US government regarding TikTok? Because everybody wants an exit for ByteDance at the moment. But this issue is like something hanging over their head all the time.
Yeah. Since you mentioned GGV, we also reported last year that GGV's stake in ByteDance originated from their investment in Musical.ly. They inherited that investment from the merger. And actually, we reported last year that GGV exited their ByteDance investment through a secondary market transaction. So I guess in a way, events like that may be an answer to the question you asked. You know, there has, you know, there are always sort of, you know, buy downs shares being offered on the secondary market at various, you know, levels of valuation. I think for some investors, if the valuation is attractive enough, they would probably still seize on that opportunity regardless of the national security risks. It all comes down to how each and every investor assesses the risk and reward equation. Obviously, you know, exit is top of the mind of every single investor.
Yeah. So, for example, there was an investor by the name of Jeff Yes, which is actually willing to support TikTok publicly. And even it has been alleged that he has some impact in making the former President Trump and also one of the presidential candidates, Vivek Ramaswamy, to change their stances on TikTok. I think the question moving forward is, how do you assess things like the roles of political affiliations and donations in shaping the investors' public stances on contentious issues like this moving forward in the US?
Yeah, so Jeff is himself is a big donor of the Republican Party, and which sort of makes him the very likely, you know, ally in the situation for TikTok. Political affiliations always always interact with, you know, investments decisions, and it's hard for me to sort of predict how it all evolve. In a way, you can probably argue that what we've seen or what has been reported about, you know, Jeff Bezos and TikTok and Trump may not really be that new, right? It's just like maybe some events have been brought to the public eyes or not, right?
Mm. So that comes to my final question then. Considering the potential ban, we don't know whether it will happen, for sale of TikTok in the US, what does the future of TikTok looks like?
You mean globally?
Yeah. What does TikTok's future look like? I mean, even for ByteDance as well. Where do you think they will go if US is shut off from them?
If we assume that happens, I'm sure TikTok, let alone ByteDance as a company as a whole, will survive and maybe even continue to thrive after this. Because let's put things into perspective, right? TikTok has more than 1 billion users globally, right? And then the US represents just a little over a tenth of that, 178 million. So I'm not saying that it's not going to impact TikTok and ByteDance, but does it pose a existential threat? Probably not. I believe, given we already talked about how ByteDance has been super profitable, I actually think that even if they get banned in the US, it's by no means the end of TikTok or ByteDance.
So Jing, many thanks for coming on the show. And we definitely will continue to monitor the situation and what happens to ByteDance or TikTok in any different ways. So in closing, I have two quick questions. Any recommendations that have inspired you recently?
Yeah, I actually put a lot of thought into this. I have two recommendations. Both are outside of technology and business.
Great recommendations.
So the first one is a book, which is Friends, Lovers, and the Big Terrible Thing, a memoir by actor Matthew Perry.
Oh.
I don't know if you are a fan of Friends.
Yes,
but
I am.
And
same
and
here.
And
Chandler Bing
is my favorite, you know, character. So I was very saddened by his passing. And then it wasn't until then that I started looking into more deeply into his life. And then I started reading this book, which is his, you know, memoir, which basically tells his lifelong battle against alcohol and drug addiction. I don't have an addiction problem. However, what really captivated me in that book is how he was able to pour, you can almost feel like he was pouring his heart out in telling the world how he tried to fight against addiction through the most part of his adulthood, and how honest and how raw those feelings, he described them. And at times, how he, you know, succumbed to addiction, but then tried again to, you know, to turn over a new leaf and, you know, for example, going to rehab again, or, you know, trying to stay dry again. And I find it really impactful, and I was really taken away by how he wrote that book, and then obviously maybe even sadder, you know, thinking about what happened to him later, because he was, based on his book, he was on like a really good place. He was in a very good place before he passed away. And if you are a fan of Friends like me, you will find a lot of, reading the book will make you want to rewatch Friends again and track how he, you know, gained and lost weight during the different seasons. And maybe if you don't know the backstory, you will think that, oh, maybe he's not, you know, snooped on, you know, a Weight Watch or something, but it's actually far from that. That basically tracked of his journey. I mean, his weight changes basically tracked his journey of fighting against addiction.
Mm. And so, second recommendation?
The second recommendation is a movie called Society of the Snow. It's a Spanish, the movie is in Spanish. The movie is based on the real life events of how a bunch of Uruguayan rugby players survived a plane crash in the snowy mountains of Andes in South America in the 1970s. The movie is long, 2.5 hours, you know, so make sure you avoid your bladder before you start watching. And I also really recommend not watching it by yourself, maybe watch it with a friend or, you know, a family member or your loved one, because it's a very hard to watch movie simply because of how they just presented and described, you know, the basic human survival instincts in front of you. And it'll make you think about what you will be like if you were in that situation. And it's a very, very well-made movie. I believe it was released on Netflix in January this year or December. Mm. And I highly recommend it.
Yeah, I just only wanted to add Matthew Perry. There's actually two performances. He seems to be very good in Aaron Sorkin type shows. One was in The West Wing, where he, I guess, a lawyer.
Yeah.
And then the other one was in Studio 60 in the Sunset Strip, which I actually watched his performances there. How do my audience find you? The information? I'm a subscriber, by the way.
Thank you for subscribing to us. Yeah, so obviously you can read all my articles on the information, and I'm also active on Twitter. You can find me at JingYangHK, and I'm also on LinkedIn.
Mm. You can definitely find us on YouTube and every part of social media and also in all the different podcast platforms. Jing, many thanks for coming on the show, and I look forward to speak to you soon.
Thank you.